Hello and welcome to Sunday Profile. I'm Monica Attard. 5 years ago, a massive car bomb killed Lebanon's Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. Now, in what must be one of the world's most sensitive investigations, the United Nations will try to name and prosecute the assassins. And leading the UN Special Tribunal is one of Australia's top cops and our guest today, Nick Caldas. Here's the way the ABC reported the car bomb which killed the Lebanese Prime Minister.
It's been 15 years since Beirut has seen destruction on this scale. The car bomb targeted Rafik Hariri as his convoy passed through a busy waterfront area. The former Prime Minister was killed instantly.
That attack killed not only the Prime Minister but 21 others travelling with him, and it injured 200 others. Tragically, it also ended Lebanon's uneasy peace between Lebanon's warring political factions, a truce which Hariri had overseen since the end of the country's civil war. Hariri had long opposed Syria's substantial influence in Lebanese politics, and in the aftermath of his execution, anti-Syrian groups claimed it was either authorised by Syrian intelligence or carried out by rogue elements of the Syrian intelligence services. Syria has denied any role. Now, 5 years on, an Arabic-speaking police officer from New South Wales will lead an international investigation to try to secure convictions against those responsible for Hariri's death and 12 other political murders and attempted murders since then. Nick Caldas will lead the UN Special Tribunal for Lebanon, which will bring witnesses and forensic evidence to any trial the tribunal chooses to hold. There are four generals who are suspects and being held in Lebanon, all of them intelligence and security chiefs from the time. It's not yet clear whether they'll be extradited to The Hague, but a decision is apparently due very soon. But I began by asking Nick Caldas if his experience in investigating Australia's first political assassination, that of the Labor MP John Newman in New South Wales, could have prepared him for the diverse and murky world of Middle East politics.
I think any murder investigation which has political overtones or some political connection can be complicated. I'm not sure that it was any less complicated than what we're dealing with now. It's just that the environment that we're dealing with in Lebanon is obviously a bit more complex and has ongoing issues, whereas the Newman murder was in a much more stable environment, obviously in the state of New South Wales. But it certainly was complicated, and as with any murder, you have to have a look at all the options, all the possibilities, all the people with the motive and so on, which we did do. And there were certainly quite a few in that case, and we had to have a look at each and every avenue and make sure it was closed off before we narrowed it down to where we ended up.
Well, I might ask you now then, are you surprised that the John Newman murder is being reinvestigated?
Not surprised. We felt, our position, the investigators and the police service have felt all along that there has been no improper behaviour by anyone in this matter, either the police, the Director of Public Prosecutions or anybody else that's involved in the matter. But obviously it's the court's prerogative if they want to hold an inquiry. The Chief Justice of New South Wales felt compelled to do so, which is his right, and we've assisted in any way we can with the judicial inquiry under His Honour Judge Patton, which is currently going on. So I'm probably a little bit limited in what I can comment about the nuts and bolts of it, but we're certainly assisting the inquiry in any way we can, and we'll look forward to an outcome and a judgment from Judge Patton at the end of it.
But at the time, you felt it was a safe conviction?
I still do. That's my view, and I think we stand by that view. I don't think there's anything wrong with a conviction. However, I don't want to preempt anything. It's obviously up to the judge to decide at the end of the day.
And nothing in the evidence that has come to public attention which led to this current investigation would lead you to believe anything other than the fact that it was a safe conviction?
I can only talk about my opinion, and in my opinion, I haven't seen anything in the last 6 months that would change my mind.
Okay, let's talk about your brief in relation to the investigation of the assassination of the former Lebanese Prime Minister. What exactly is your brief? Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. It's effectively an investigation into the assassination of former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri in Lebanon, and I think there was 20-odd other people who were also killed with him in that incident. As well as that, there are a number of other assassinations or attempted assassinations that this tribunal has been tasked with investigating. It is very much a joint investigation with Lebanese authorities. In fact, the Lebanese government, I think, funds half of the costs and so on, about 49%. And we do have a number of Lebanese police officers and investigators working very much hand in glove with the team that's investigating all these incidents.
It was 4 years ago. Why is it so complex? Why is it so difficult to investigate?
I think you just need to look at the international environment with these sort of investigations. Firstly, the state of Lebanon had to decide that it wanted assistance from the international community, and clearly they've done that on this occasion. If you look at comparable investigations into other incidents overseas, as in Rwanda, Sierra Leone, former Republic of Yugoslavia and so on, none of those cases are ones that were able to be finalised within a year or two. Mm-hmm. They are complex by their very nature. Things are complicated by the international perspective when different jurisdictions and so on become involved, and everyone tries to make sure that everything is done once and done right. So it's about taking your time, I guess, to make sure that everyone's needs are acquitted, and hopefully we'll do it once and do it right.
But given that it's Lebanon, given Lebanon's strategic place in the Middle East, I suppose this is possibly one of the more sensitive murder investigations that is being conducted currently in the world.
Yeah.
Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would. Hmm. I'd probably take it a bit further. We've recognised, and we're certainly the investigation team is acutely aware of how important this is to the Lebanese people, not only in Lebanon but worldwide, in Australia and South America also, where there are sizable Lebanese communities. And we're acutely aware that they're very much looking forward to an outcome from this investigation.
Well, let's talk about the implications. What are the implications? Say you can finger somebody or a group. What are the implications?
It's very difficult at this early stage for me to make any comment publicly about who we're looking at or what direction it may take. But suffice to say, we will be acutely aware as we move forward that what we say and do will be under intense glare, both as it already is, I have to say, in the media and the public in Lebanon and in the political environment. There are elections looming in Lebanon in June, I think. And certainly a lot of people are watching very closely what we do and are making a lot of commentaries on it.
Now, Hariri was very influential in the Middle East, and he had campaigned to end Syria's 29-year occupation of Lebanon. And the UN supported that with a resolution calling for Syria's withdrawal and the disarming of Hezbollah. It would seem a relatively easy proposition from an outside perspective to actually point the finger fairly and squarely at Syria, and a lot of people, in fact, are doing that. At this point in time, what are you able to tell us about the status of the investigation and where it's at right now?
There are a number of lines of inquiry that are being pursued, but it's very unfair of me to point a finger at anyone at this stage, and I appreciate the fact, and you're quite right, there are people pointing fingers in various directions. I think it's probably very unfair to do that as well at this point in time. They need to wait until the inquiry it concludes, reaches a conclusion, and then announces what it is that we've found. We are very, very aware that we need to spell out as often as we can, as loudly as we can, that the inquiry is impartial. We do not have any role or part or take sides in any way, shape or form in either the Lebanese political environment or the Middle East political environment. That's not what we're there for. We are, I hope, truly an independent body which has been tasked with investigating incidents and will do so with a very open mind and a very independent stance.
I'm sure none of that is actually in dispute, but when you look at the facts, I mean, a report to the United Nations outlines a plan of remarkable complexity. I mean, there were cuts to Hariri's security detail, anonymously bought mobile phones used on the day of the attack to keep the bomber informed of the Prime Minister's movements. They seem to be hallmarks of a very, very well-planned, sophisticated operation, perhaps even the operation of a government.
Yeah, I wouldn't take it that far from what we know, but what I would say is it appears to be certainly, as you said, Monica, a very well-planned, complex operation which resulted in the tragedy that's happened. What I can say is all the lines of inquiry you've mentioned, all the issues that have been raised in the 11 reports that were made by the commissioners over the last 4 years or so are all being combed over again. No stone will be left unturned. And Judge Bill Maher, who's currently in charge but will become the chief prosecutor as of the 1st of March when a formal tribunal is born in The Hague, has made that very clear. no stone will be left unturned, and we are very much committed to getting to the bottom of the matter.
Now, why you? Why do they pick you to lead this investigation?
There's a couple of things I guess I bring to the table at the risk of sounding conceited.
No, please do.
I do have homicide experience, obviously, for over a decade or so, and a few years of that as the commander of the squad, in fact. I am an Arab by birth, and I'm quite proud of being an Australian, but I think I'm even more proud of being an Arab. And I'm fluent in the language, and I do have some cultural awareness. I also have a capacity, I hope, to perform in difficult situations without taking my eye off the ball.
So, given all of that, given what you bring to the table, I imagine that still mentally, this is quite a challenging role. I mean, how do you go about undertaking this task?
I think it's great to approach everything in a structured way and not to reinvent the wheel. There are very good systems and processes that we have in a lot of the Western countries, and those will be brought to bear on the investigation. I have a really diverse team that come from very disparate locations, from around the globe, not only from Western countries, but also from some from Eastern Europe and certainly some from Africa and so on, Asia and so on. And I'm very fortunate to have that diversity within the team, and it all comes into a melting pot that will hopefully take us forward. At the end of the day, it is a mammoth task. There are a lot of people watching what we do. I guess what we'll be doing is perhaps biting off more than we can chew, and chew like hell.
It sounds like a very, very tough role. Now, but as you say, there is a massive team of investigators behind this effort. But according to some reports, some of the investigators who followed the trail of evidence actually feared for their lives. You had a German prosecutor step down quite recently after he'd been informed that his life was in danger. Now that you're involved in the really critical part of this investigation, the time when really what the UN wants is some names, do you have any fears about your own safety?
No, I mean, we obviously exercise the usual caution and the cautious steps, security arrangements and so on. But I don't think I or anybody else on the team will be dissuaded from doing what we have to do by threats.
But do you fear? Do you have fears for your life?
No.
You truly don't?
No, I don't think. I think the position of Chief of Investigations in an independent international tribunal ought to be some protection, notwithstanding what's happened in the past. I honestly believe that I don't think anyone would be silly enough to do anything to that position.
They were silly enough to knock off the Lebanese Prime Minister.
Look, it's a different sort of situation. I think the public glare on the events that followed that assassination, in my view, would hopefully make it harder for the assassins to simply continue with what's called a culture of impunity.
You'll be based in The Hague?
Mainly, yes.
But you'll travel back and forth to Lebanon?
Yes, and other places, I'd suggest.
In the Middle East?
Yes, wherever the inquiry takes us, basically, we'll be following.
If you do manage, Nick, to find those responsible for the plot and for the assassination, I imagine that that would mean something very particular to you at a personal level?
Yes, I think, as with any murder investigation, and certainly particularly with this one, when you solve the case and you reach a conclusion, there is a sense of satisfaction, which is probably what makes all of us join the police. It's what makes all of us go into the plainclothes or criminal investigation work. And at the end of the day, if you didn't have that sense of satisfaction, then you probably wouldn't continue to do what you do. It's really about righting the wrongs. It's about giving the families of victims closure and enabling them to get on with their lives. It's simply about doing what's right.
And in this particular case, in relation to the Lebanese Prime Minister, is your own Arabic background of particular significance to you? Does that background give you a burning desire to solve this one in particular?
I wouldn't say that, no. I think I understand what's happening perhaps a bit more than some people, or most people. But by the same token, I don't think I was any less motivated in any other murder investigation that I've been involved in. It's just that there are complexities, obviously, with this one that may not have existed with others.
Now, so there are 12 murders on the table for you at the moment, and quite possibly more to come.
There's some attempted assassinations and some actual assassinations.
Can you tell me anything about any of those?
There are a number of cases that are before the tribunal, and one of the things the tribunal will be doing very early in the piece is to determine definitively which cases will be looked at and which ones won't. That's not a decision the tribunal will make unilaterally, even though it does have Lebanese government representation. It's very much a joint decision between the tribunal and the Lebanese government.
And will you be involved in that decision-making process?
It's at a higher level than me.
Yeah. Now, let's go back in time, because you've got a fascinating background. You're Egyptian-born. You've risen to the heights of the New South Wales police force. You've recently served in Iraq to help train Iraqi policemen. First of all, how did you end up in Australia?
My family are Coptic Orthodox, which is a Christian minority in Egypt, and we do have a propensity to migrate, as a lot of people do from the Middle East. We migrated to Australia. I guess we looked at America, but I think the line was too long, and I think my father felt that Canada was too cold, and the quirks of fate took place, and here we are in Australia.
Where did you come?
We came straight to Sydney and lived in Marrickville for a while, and then ultimately we've never really moved away from Sydney. We've been here the whole time.
And what did your father do when he came here?
Anything he could, to be honest. I think he drove a courier truck for a while. He worked on the factory floor, and then ultimately he started his own business in laundry and dry cleaning, and that went quite well. He passed away many years ago, but I'm certainly inspired by his will to succeed, and I hope I've inherited a little bit of that. And I think we're certainly not unique. I think the migrant spirit of reaching out and seeking a better life for your kids is truly well and alive in Australia, and it's something that a lot of us have inherited, I think. I think we may have a fair bit of motivation because of who we are and where we've come from. You didn't come all this way over here to fail, I guess, in life.
Mm. Do you remember Egypt at all?
Very much. I was nearly 12 years old when we migrated.
And what made you gravitate towards the police?
I guess in many ways I really knew what I wanted from a young age. It's what I've always wanted to do.
Always wanted to be a cop.
And specifically in criminal investigation and specifically major crime. I probably didn't spend a great deal of time in uniform. I gravitated towards criminal investigation and I've been there for quite some years now.
When you were head of homicide, you oversaw a number of very high-profile cases. Was Carolyn Byrne one of those cases?
Yes.
Is that a case that you wouldn't put up as a great success? I mean, it took a long time to resolve, didn't it?
It's difficult to qualify what is a success and what is not. In terms of achieving a result, arresting someone, putting all the evidence before the court...
And getting a conviction.
And getting a conviction, I think it has been a success. It was a complex matter, complicated by some factors that took place right after the murder. What I can say is that the police role in this is simply to gather the evidence without taking sides, without being emotional, without being swayed by anyone, which is exactly what happened in this case. And I have to commend the detectives that were involved in that case that ultimately took it to court as being absolutely committed to the task, tenacious in their investigation, and never saying give up.
But now, it took 14 years, didn't it? Is there anything that you can say about the early investigation? I mean, why did it take so long for homicide to become involved in that investigation?
I think there was probably a different system in place at the beginning of this matter that has been enhanced, improved and refined very much since those days. We have a system in place now where the expertise of the homicide squad is called on far more systematically and regularly by local area detectives. And I would hope that we are in a much better position to provide that support to detectives in the suburbs. The circumstances very early in this case could have been handled better, I'm not sure. But certainly what I can say is, once homicide became involved, there was an absolute commitment to the task and support of the victim's family. And obviously the result speaks for itself, having been to the court.
But even in the early stages of homicide's involvement, there were issues concerning staff allocation, that there weren't enough resources. Is that something that still plagues homicide, do you think?
No, I don't think so. And I think, to be fair, I mean, homicide is the worst crime, obviously. The murder of another human being is something that we have to throw everything at but the kitchen sink. But we also live in an environment where we don't have infinite resources in government. The task of managers and leaders in policing generally is to prioritise and to try and cope with what's coming through the door. I wish we had an infinite amount of resources to right the wrongs. We don't. What we have to do is to say, if something is a hot issue, if it's happening right now, if we're going to lose evidence by not acting in a particular matter now, that has to take priority, and I think that's what happened in some various junctures in time in this particular matter, and that at various points in time, there were other issues that were really burning that had to be attended to straight away. And if I can describe it as a cold case murder, you knew that if you left it for a little while and then came back to it, you would not lose any evidence. And we certainly did come back to it, and that was always the intention.
But you can understand the frustration felt by Carolyn Byrne's father, for example.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I know Tony very well, and I feel very much his pain. I can't pretend to understand how he feels in terms of, you know, what was going on. But what I can say is we certainly kept in touch with him. At the end of the day, I don't think anything less than what has actually occurred can satisfy some people. And that's perfectly understandable. I think if your daughter or your son or your loved one is murdered, you want to see somebody in the dock. You want to see someone convicted and you want closure. It's human nature to want closure of the issue where everything is resolved. We're acutely aware of that. We certainly did try and meet that need. But, you know, we have to also accept that there will be a percentage of cases where we don't actually do that. Mm. We don't achieve those things for the families. All we can do is do our best and try as hard as we can.
There is an appeal on foot in relation to the Carolyn Byrne trial. In your mind, is that a safe conviction?
I believe it is, but it's simply my opinion, and I really shouldn't comment any further than that because the matter will be before the court shortly.
Now, last year you gave a speech and you said that modern criminal trials are too complex for juries to understand. Can you explain that comment?
I have to say that was a controversial comment, certainly on the day. It was in an international law conference. What I was getting at is that if you look at fraud matters at the moment, if you look at terrorism trials at the moment, and I'm not for a minute commenting on any specific matter, I'm simply talking generally, there are complexities, and some of these matters are expected to sit for perhaps over 12 months. And I simply raise the issue, I wonder whether it might be time for us to look at some alternatives to the trial by jury traditional methods that we have had for a couple of centuries in this country. And I'd specifically look at the inquisitorial system that occurs in Europe. If you look at France, Spain, Italy, Germany, they're all functioning, thriving democracies. I don't think anyone can say any of those countries are dictatorships in any way, shape or form. And yet they all don't have a, strictly speaking, trial by jury. They operate more in the inquisitorial system where it's about finding out the truth. An inquiring magistrate or judge getting to the heart of the matter and finding out what happened, rather than adversaries, which we have, the adversarial common law system, where two lawyers compete, if you like, to convince a jury or a judge about where the truth lies. Mm. I just think the jury system has served us very well. It's a wonderful system, obviously. But it may well be occasions in modern-day law enforcement and the modern-day judicial environment where you may look at other alternatives.
And you're not proposing this across the board. You weren't proposing the complete abolition of the jury system, merely in relation to some category of crime.
Yes. And I mean, far smarter men than me, I'm sure, would look at how that might work. But I certainly wasn't advocating anything. All I'm saying is perhaps it's a discussion that we ought to start to have, and perhaps the legal profession generally ought to be more engaged, if you like, in looking at alternatives. There is, without being critical of anyone in any way, shape or form, human nature tends to gravitate towards the resistance to change. And I don't think the police are exempt from that, and I don't think the legal profession is certainly not exempt from that. That resistance to change sometimes holds us back. Mm. And I felt that it may be time for us to simply look at some other alternatives for some categories of cases that are before the court. And as I say, if you look at a matter that's going to be going for over 12 months, to have a jury of 12 or more if the judge sees fit to swear more, I'm not sure that there are a whole lot of people that want to be sitting in a court for 12 months and put their lives and careers on hold. Mm. And that's another reason I think it may be time for us to look at some alternatives. Mm. These sorts of things didn't happen 150 years ago or 100 years ago or 50 years ago. The complexity has certainly increased. The technological age has added a layer of complexity, certainly in some of the fraud matters that we see, where it's very difficult for the layman to really comprehend a lot of the evidence that's put before them.
And has the legislative responses to those crimes, complex as it is, the legislation as such, has that also created another layer of difficulty for laypeople?
Look, I think the legislature very much, across the Western world, has tried very hard not only to keep up with these technology changes, but to address them in a meaningful way with legislation. But there has to be a lag sometimes. The effect of some of these changes in the age of technology take a while to be seen properly and to be addressed, obviously, in legislation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Monica. Thanks for your time.
That was Nick Caldas, the New South Wales Deputy Police Commissioner, who's now leading the investigation in the United Nations case against as yet unnamed murderers of Lebanon's former Prime Minister Rafik Hariri. And we'll watch with interest the potentially enormous implications of any prosecutions in The Hague. Thanks for listening to Sunday Profile. I'm Monica Attard, and the program's producer is Belinda Summer. Visit our website if you like at abc.net.au/Sunday Profile, where you can see and hear previous interviews from this year. Speaking Out is up next.